Good morning. My name is Alicia, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I'd like to welcome everyone to the ICN Unilateral Conduct Working Group Teleseminar on Remedies conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you'd like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Marcus Langer, you may begin your conference.
Thank you very much. This is Marcus Langer of the Bundeskartellamt, and I'd like to welcome all participants and listeners to today's teleseminar on remedies in unilateral conduct cases. And I'd like to welcome you also on behalf of the co-chair of the Unilateral Conduct Working Group, Randy Tritel of the FTC. Now, teleseminars have become an important tool in the work of ICN. They've proved very effective for sharing experience and fostering the development of consensus, but also, of course, as fora where we can agree to disagree. Today's teleseminar is the second held by the Unilateral Conduct Working Group. The first seminar was held on excessive pricing. It was very well received. With more than 100 participants, and a recording of that teleseminar is posted on the ICN website. Today's seminar aims to promote the understanding of remedies in unilateral conduct cases, and it's the second part of a mini-series of seminars on the issue of remedies following a seminar devoted to this subject in the merger working group in February this year. There are slides prepared that will lead you through today's seminar. They've been mailed to you, and they can be downloaded from the ICN website. Those of you who have registered in advance can also follow along by going on the link provided to you. Before going into today's agenda, I would like to thank all those, both at the FTC and the Bundeskartellamt, who have worked hard and shown a lot of dedication in preparing today's teleseminar. And I would also like to thank our panelists and speakers who've kindly agreed to participate in today's event. Besides Randy Tritel, who will be moderating, these are Howard Shalansky, Wolfgang Wieselas, Matthew Callison, Barbara Rosenberg, and Hiroshi Yamada. Today's agenda looks as follows. Randy Tritel will take over in a minute to introduce the substantive part of the session. There will be a presentation of principles and issues to be considered in crafting remedies by Howard Shalansky. Then we will have a panel discussion on a first hypothetical case, followed by a Q&A session. Then there will be a panel discussion on a second hypothetical case, again, with a Q&A session to follow before we close today's session. Now I'm happy to hand over to Randy Tritel.
Thank you, Marcus. Dominance cases may be interesting, but no one said they're easy. The theories are often complex and controversial. The facts may be difficult to investigate. It may be difficult to prove harm. And when you're all finished with that set of issues and have proven your case, you have another set of problems, or at least challenges. How can you stop, deter, and punish properly the company for its unlawful conduct, especially without causing even more problems, such as impairing the ability of the dominant firm to compete or causing years of headaches for your agency to monitor the remedy? In today's teleseminar, we're going to bring together agency and practitioner experts from four continents to share their experience and expertise on these issues. As Marcus said, we use teleseminars to address the difficult issues that may not be readily amenable to consensus normative guidance such as recommended practices. Here, we seek to highlight issues, enhance understanding, and learn from colleagues around the world. I hope you'll find that we achieve these goals. Let me now briefly introduce our panelists. More detailed information is available on the slides, but to save time, please take my word that they are all experienced experts in the field of unilateral conduct remedies. Our opening speaker, Howard Shalansky, is the Deputy Director for Antitrust in the Bureau of Economics of the U.S. Federal Trade Commission. Howard is a lawyer and PhD economist who also teaches at the law schools of the University of California, Berkeley, and Georgetown University. Howard has also served as chief economist of the U.S. Federal Communications Commission and as senior economist to the President's Council of Economic Advisors, and he's a heck of a nice guy. We have representatives from two competition agencies. Matthew Kellison is a senior competition law officer in the Canadian Competition Bureau who specializes in cases of abuse of dominance and other matters involving regulated industries, including telecoms. Second, we have Hiroshi Yamada, who's the Director of International Affairs at the Japan Fair Trade Commission and previously headed the group responsible for major unilateral conduct matters. We also have with us two of our non-governmental advisor experts to the working group. Dr. Wolfgang Fieselard is a partner in the Brussels and Dusseldorf offices of the Linklaters law firm. Wolfgang has been involved in dominance proceedings before the German Federal Cartel Office, the European Commission, and German and European courts over the past 20 years, which makes him almost as old as I. Barbara Rosenberg, our other NGA, is in the firm of Barbosa, Musnick, and Aragão Advogados, based in Brasilia, and also has a wealth of experience in unilateral conduct matters. Before going to our discussion, I too would like to take a moment to thank all the people, in addition to our panelists, who made this program possible. That, of course, includes my co-chair, Marcus, and Thilo Reimers from the Bundeskartellamt, Alden Abbott and Andrew Heimer from the FTC, who, among other things, took a lead role on the hypotheticals, and Cynthia Lai DeMeo from the FTC, who played an indispensable role in conceiving, organizing, and implementing this program. With that, let me turn over our program to our opening speaker, Howard Chalansky.
Hello, and thank you very much for participating and for inviting me to speak this morning. My job is just to give a brief overview of remedies in unilateral conduct cases. I want to talk about the kinds of remedies, the hazards that might arise with different kinds of remedies, and some of the policy issues we might consider in designing remedies in unilateral conduct cases. I think one place to start off is to recognize that remedies are something that should be thought about early in a unilateral conduct case. They're an important integral part of any enforcement action. And one might be well to consider the wisdom of bringing an enforcement action if there really is no feasible remedy for the conduct at issue. Now, that is not to say that a finding of liability or a finding of illegal conduct is not in itself valuable. If one considers the law enforcement mission of competition authorities, a strong signal can be sent that certain kind of conduct will be intolerable, even if in a particular case it is not remediable. So the absence of a remedy doesn't necessarily mean that a case should not be brought, but it should be, I think, a weighty factor in deciding whether to go forward. So remedies should be considered early, and the absence of a remedy should be an important factor in the discretionary decision by an agency about whether to proceed with a case. Once a case has gone forward and remedy is being considered, there are a number of remedial goals that an enforcement agency might consider for unilateral conduct cases. Certainly, terminating the unlawful conduct would be the simplest and most straightforward remedy, but one also wishes to prevent its recurrence, to restore the possibility of competition in the relevant market, that is to say, to actually remedy the harm that has been done on a going forward basis. And finally, one may wish to send a deterrent message to make sure that not only the firm at issue in the case, but others considering similar conduct might not engage in it again. Different remedial approaches can be used to achieve these goals. They have different administrative costs, different consequences for efficiency and innovation. And I think one can say at a general level that the preferable remedy will be the one that accomplishes the goals of stopping illegal conduct and restoring competition while minimizing the costs of remedial design and administration and minimizes the deterrent effect on beneficial conduct, that is to say, efficient actions and investment in innovation. It's easy to say that at a high level. How do you break that down across different classes of potential remedies? I would like to talk briefly about four different kinds of remedies one might adopt in unilateral conduct cases in this regard. The first two categories fall under the general heading of behavioral remedies or conduct remedies. And these fall into two categories, prohibitory conduct remedies and affirmative conduct remedies, those that impose an actual affirmative duty on the party involved. A third category, quite distinct from conduct remedies, are structural remedies. What can we do to fundamentally change the incentives of a firm engaging in anti-competitive unilateral conduct going forward? Are there structural remedies that might be involved? And one can, of course, think of the renowned breakup of the Bell system in the United States in 1984 as a canonical conduct remedy where the long-distance business was structurally separated from the local exchange business at which the monopoly had a bottleneck where they could discriminate against long-distance competitors. So structural remedies. And finally, penalties. So let me talk briefly about these different remedies, starting with what I would call prohibitory conduct remedies. Prohibitory conduct remedies typically enjoin either the continuance or repetition of conduct found to be illegal, or of conduct having a similar effect realized through similar means. And I'll explain what that means, but it's basically what is often called fencing in relief. It is relief that might go beyond the immediate conduct in a case to conduct that can be anticipated to have a similar effect. An important advantage of prohibitory remedies is that typically they enjoin conduct already found to be inefficient, conduct that has already occurred, whose effects we can observe, or conduct reasonably related to that conduct. And by enjoining the continuance or repetition of conduct found to have been inefficient, enforcers reduce the cost of identifying and formulating a remedy, and the risks of formulating, they minimize the risks of formulating an overbroad one. They simply issue a behavioral injunction prohibiting the conduct at issue. That is not to say that prohibitory conduct remedies are simple. They may be simple to design and describe, but there are, of course, difficult ex post monitoring issues. How does one observe if the conduct is being continued? How do we make sure that the incentives that customers or those affected have adequate incentives to report the continuance of the conduct? But they are at least the most straightforward of the set of remedies. By contrast, affirmative conduct remedies, those remedies that have that require conduct, those may be indicated where, or may be required, where prohibitory remedies are inadequate to restore the possibility of competition. These types of remedies, however, are generally costlier to design and administer than prohibitory remedies. They may involve, for example, mandated dealing, compulsory licensing, various kinds of remedies in that regard that may require the specification of terms of dealing or other kinds of rules of the road for the affirmative conduct being required. These requirements put the competition authority into somewhat of a regulatory mode and can risk efficient conduct, chilling efficient conduct, and deterring innovation and beneficial investment. Now, these costs, of course, can be mitigated by insisting on a close and careful connection between the conduct mandated by the remedy and the proven violation of competition law. And one also generally wants to mitigate the harms by avoiding affirmative remedies of long duration, to have a sunset clause, as we would call it, or some mechanism by which the remedy can be revisited. But affirmative conduct remedies, nonetheless, as I've mentioned, are difficult to design. They can be difficult to administer, and again, we must be careful about chilling incentives to innovate. That said, there are many cases where they are simply the only remedy that will satisfy the criteria of preventing the harmful conduct and restoring competition. Let me switch now to structural remedies. Historically, structural remedies have been a very important tool for governmental unilateral conduct remedies. I mentioned the AT&T case here in the United States. Structural relief can involve significant upfront administrative costs, however, and they also can risk impairing the efficiency or internal synergies of the divested firm's operations. It's not always so easy to know where to make the cuts or how to separate a firm's operations. Nevertheless, in key situations, such a remedy may be appropriate, particularly where there is a clear causal link between the challenged conduct and the acquisition of and or maintenance of monopoly power, and where affirmative conduct remedies may be simply too costly to design and administer. Sometimes it is better to uproot the underlying incentive to engage in anti-competitive conduct through a structural remedy than to try to monitor and limit that incentive through conduct remedies. Finally, there is the category of civil penalties. Of course, not all jurisdictions have access to all of the remedies that I've been discussing here, but where possible, civil penalties as a remedy have very attractive features, particularly in jurisdictions that do not have a private damages action. If one thinks about the Intel action in the European Union, in the absence at the time of private action against Intel, the penalties remedy was the preferred option. Civil penalties can avoid many of the costs of designing and administering a conduct or structural remedy, and if carefully tied to the actual harm inflicted by the defendant, may avoid significant risks of chilling incentives to innovate or engage in efficient conduct. Now, again, there can be a deterrent effect if a penalty is too high, a deterrent effect on firms that say, if I take a risk with certain kinds of competitive conduct, I may be over-penalized. But as a general matter, one can design these conducts and tie them to the gains from the illegal conduct. And in fact, one may wish to have penalties that are multiples of the gains from illegal conduct to deter such illegality ex ante. That multiple, of course, has to be balanced against the concern for chilling what one would describe as ex ante efficient conduct. So there, in very brief overview, are four different approaches to remedies in unilateral conduct cases, two kinds of conduct remedies, prohibitory remedies and affirmative conduct remedies, structural remedies, and penalties. And with that, I would like to turn it back to Randy and so that we can move on with applying these principles to the hypotheticals. Thank you.
And thank you, Howard. As Marcus mentioned, our program is built around two hypothetical scenarios that we hope will allow us all to grapple with the points Howard has just raised in a context that bears some relation to real-world situations that you may encounter. The first involves a refusal to deal. Keep in mind that for purposes of this program, liability has been established, and we're dealing only with what remedies should be imposed. If you have the materials that were circulated or on the webinar, it's probably easiest to follow the text on the slides rather than listening to me drone through the hypothetical, but if not, please bear with me as I present it. So for our first hypothetical, we're going to deal with Big Tel, which is a dominant firm domiciled in Phoneland, note our clever script writing, that controls 100% of Phoneland local telephone services. Big Tel owns each of three geographically separate local telephone exchanges in Phoneland. Big Tel also has an 80% share in wired long-distance services, an 80% share in cellular services, and a 90% share in retail internet service provision, hence Big Tel. Big Tel is a formerly state-owned enterprise that is not currently subject to sector regulation. Realize that telecoms companies may be subject to regulation in some jurisdictions, but we wanted to take that largely out of the equation and look at this through a purely competition law lens. Phoneland's Competition Commission, ComCom, has found that Big Tel has engaged in anti-competitive practices aimed at retaining its monopoly in local, long-distance, cellular, and internet services, including, and here are three practices. First, refusing to interconnect with wireless cellular carriers that want access to local exchange except on terms that would cause the wireless carriers to operate at a loss. Second, refusing to provide access to local exchange switches to prospective wholesalers of local telecom services. And third, refusing to allow other cellular companies wholesale access to internet transport services, which would be required to stimulate retail competition in internet service provision. Having established those violations, ComCom is considering alternative remedies to combat Big Tel's monopoly power. Those fall into the categories of structural and behavioral relief. On the structural side, one considered remedy is breaking Big Tel into four companies, each maintaining one of PhoneLand's three local telephone exchange services, and a fourth company owning all of Big Tel's other assets. Second possibility, structural relief, breaking Big Tel into three companies, with one maintaining local services, one long distance and cellular, and the third owning internet services. It might also consider other structural reconfigurations. Alternatively, ComCom is considering behavioral relief, requiring Big Tel to interconnect with wireless cellular carriers and to provide access to both local exchange switches and internet transport services. Now, you can ponder whether that should be done at cost-based rates on so-called RAND or FRAND, fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory terms that allow new competitors to cover costs and, quote, compete effectively, or other forms of behavioral relief. So that is the setup for our ensuing discussion, and we'd like to explore the issues it raises. So let's get into our panel discussion. And I'm going to first ask Mr. Yamada from the JFTC, what problem are we trying to resolve, or is ComCom trying to resolve, in designing a remedy? Is it trying to restore competitive conditions, to deter or prevent unlawful conduct, to create a level playing field, to punish the firm, to restore competition that was eliminated by the conduct? I think it's important in designing a remedy to keep in mind the goal. What goal might a competition agency have in mind? Hiroshi.
Rodney, thank you very much. And in Japan, and under the Japanese competition law, in a case not only the unilateral conduct, but also every anti-competitive cases such as Consell, Japan Federal Commission issues an order to the violators to take necessary measures in order to exclude anti-competitive conduct and to restore the competition which was destroyed by the violators. In concrete, the FTC orders the violators to cease the conduct and not to be engaged in a similar conduct in the future. This is an in general conclusion of the FTC to conclude the case. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Now I'm going to ask the same question from the perspective of Barbara Rosenberg, and I'm going to ask our NGAs to respond from the perspective of their experience in their own jurisdiction, but also to offer a private sector practitioner perspective on these questions. Barbara?
Yeah, thanks, Randy. As was already mentioned by Shalansky, I think that the main goal in this case is that remedies are aimed at curing or correcting or and preventing unlawful conduct in the future. And I think that the important point in the case and the hypothetical we are discussing here is that, generally speaking, the monopolization itself is not prohibited and it would not be punished, but rather any abusive conduct that occurs in this context. As such, it seems that the remedy really needs to bring the illicit conduct to an end. This is, I believe, is the view overall and was mentioned by Shalansky. And in this specific case, it will aim at preventing that the conduct could leverage the market power that Big Tel has in the local market to the other markets where that could be more competitive, such as internet and cellular and so on. In this, and in addition, if we are, you asked what would be the scope indeed, so besides resolving the issue and bringing competition back, a deterrence effect could be also added, and a number of jurisdictions take that into account, and they do that by means of imposing fines that would have the scope of really deterring the conduct in future cases, either by the company or by third parties, as was already mentioned to by Shalansky as well. I think we can go on details when we talk about more about this.
Very good. Thanks, Barbara. I'm now going to ask Matthew and Wolfgang if they'd like to add any comments on this point.
Well, I can add that in, or confirm that also in the German and in the EU context, the typical remedy in such refusal to deal cases is to require the dominant company to grant access on friend terms, and in particular the same terms as granted to the dominant company's own downstream activities. Structural remedies, in turn, are normally not imposed in view of the principle of proportionality. And to your question on what is the objective, well, In the German and EU context, to hold a dominant position or even to attempt to monopolize a market as such is not prohibited, but only a specific abusive conduct. And therefore, the objective of a remedy is to bring this specific conduct to an end and not to restore effective competition or to regulate the market or to benefit consumers. If there are several remedies available, which would bring the infringement to an end, it is up to the dominant company and not the regulator to choose. And given that structural remedies are normally more burdensome than behavioral remedies, the structural remedies are normally excluded. There are, in fact, only two exceptions in the German energy case, in the German energy sector. And if we have time, I can elaborate on that a little bit later.
And I think the situation would be more or less the same in Canada as the one that Wolfgang outlined. We are not concerned with the with the exercise of market power or the prices that result from market power as much as we're concerned with the abuse of market power. And what we'd be concerned about in a case like this would be a dominant provider in one market essentially being able to leverage that market power into other markets that might otherwise be more competitive. And so we'd want to address that behavior, whether it be a refusal or whether it be some other means of raising rivals' costs, rather than address the initial market power itself. We basically seek to remedy the conduct such that the conditions to compete in those markets still existed, but we wouldn't go so far as to take action against the market power inherent in Big Tel services.
Thanks. We've already now introduced into the discussion the prospect of structural remedies. In the United States, there's authority to issue structural remedies, but that is a remedy that is resorted to rather rarely. Let's take a few minutes on the question of structural remedies, starting again with Hiroshi. What kind of circumstances could one imagine in Japan or in your experience that might justify the use of a structural remedy in a case such as Big Tel?
Yes, Ronnie. I think that in such a case that where the company is in a position of a dominant position had accomplished its monopolistic position in the market by way of the conduct such as the refusal to deal, etc. In such a case, it's impossible to restore the competition in the market just only by orders to cease their conduct, but also to exclude the market power itself, which enabled the conduct. Therefore, the Japanese competition law allows the JFTC to order the structural measures, such as the divestiture of the business, etc. But, however, the JFTC has not the order in a few cases the FTC has issued certain structural measures because the Japanese competition law has a conception that if the competition in the market was excluded by the a certain conduct, in such a case, it's sufficient to exclude the conduct itself, and it's not necessary to order such a structural measure. I just say that the structural measures is a last resort. I think this is the notion of the structural measures in Japan. Thank you.
Thank you. Is the situation similar or different in other jurisdictions? Allowable, but last resort. Do our other speakers want to add some comments on this point?
I'll just add, this is Barbara speaking, I'll just add a very quick comment. My understanding is that that's true for all jurisdictions, and that structural remedies tend to be taken only in those cases where an effective behavioral remedy is not available. And I think the main issue to be taken into account is indeed the principle of proportionality, and it may be even ineffective to take some measure that in terms of verticalization, for instance, some structural remedies could even lead to inefficient marketing, or market structure. So I think the main goal of the authority would be really to take a measure that would restore competition rather than having the risk of creating any type of inefficiency. Something that could be brought in terms of structural remedies relates more to cases where a remedy is negotiated with the party. And in those cases, we see more experiences, at least that's my experience, of structural remedies being agreed between the authorities and the parties. And in those cases, the structural remedies may be successful, but that's a very particular situation.
This is Howard Schlansky just jumping in. I think the point Barbara just made is very important. When you look historically at the large structural remedies cases, again, returning to the actual AT&T case here in the United States, those were negotiated over a period of years with many of the key assets of the divestiture actually initiated by the company itself. So their success may often hinge on that very negotiation Barbara just identified, an important point.
Good. Well, let's then consider the possibility that ComCom issue a fine or require the disgorgement of excess profits. In the view of our speakers, what would be the merits or drawbacks of using that remedy as an alternative to a breakup?
If I can jump in, Randy, I believe that the main scope of a fine or a disgorgement would be really to act in terms of, taking a punitive approach. And I don't see that as being an alternative to any behavioral remedy, as I believe that the scopes are different. Normally, a behavioral remedy would be going most at restoring competition, as we have all said, while applying a fine, and this can be added to any type of remedy, would have the goal of deterring future conduct, either by the company that has engaged in the illegal conduct or by any third party. So I would consider them as being added. Of course, if the behavior remedy imposes further burdens, maybe the fine can be calibrated not to be that high or the other way around.
Okay, well, you've raised another good point, which is in addition to whether fines are in principle an appropriate remedy, how does one know what the right level of fine is, or if one is going to require the disgorgement of profits to measure those profits? Let me ask our agency panelists if they would like to comment on those points. Hiroshi or Matthew, in terms of the efficacy or determination of a fine?
Well, I think when you look at something like that in I can only speak from the Canadian perspective, we actually just amended our Competition Act this past year to allow for what we call administrative monetary penalties under our abuse of dominance provision. They're not criminal fines, they're civil penalties. They're intended, or I can't say how they're intended specifically, that's Parliament, but they're we see them as a deterrent more than a specific remedy. They can be ordered by our competition tribunal, which is the court where we litigate these matters, only in addition to some other order prohibiting or divesting, to remedy the conduct. So we would not consider a fine or a penalty to be an alternative to a behavioral remedy. We do have factors in our legislation that outline how those fines are calculated in terms of whether it's recidivist conduct, whether it's particularly egregious, whether it affects a certain volume of commerce. And we can seek an order of up to $10 million for a first offense or $15 million for a subsequent offense. But at this point, we don't have a lot of experience either applying for those penalties or assessing what the appropriate level is.
Okay, and would anybody else like to come in on this? If one is going to fine, is there a formula to determine how much? Are there factors that are important to consider in determining the level of the fine in the experience of either the officials or of the lawyers who have been involved on the other side of these cases?
Well, this is Hiroshi. I'd like to introduce the Japanese system. Our Japanese competition law was amended in 2009, and the so-called the private monopolies conduct were punished by the surcharges. The violators would be imposed the surcharges, which will be calculated by the multiplied as 6% of the turnover during the period of time of the violation. The surcharge system was introduced in order to disgorge the excessive profit, as well as to make the violators not to be engaged in the similar conduct, so-called vita, the violation, in the future. In a sense of the deterring power of the surcharge system, I consider that probably has the same meaning of the structural measures, because the structural measures is aiming at the deterred the violators not to be engaged in a similar conduct, so the such a system or monetary punishment has the same meaning. Thank you.
Thank you. So having looked at to structural remedies and fines, let's turn to what most of you identified as the principal remedy that ComCom might consider in this matter, which is behavioral relief. And let me throw out a few questions that could arise in designing behavioral relief. How should that be determined? Should the parties negotiate rates? Or else who would determine the price and terms of access or interconnection if the parties can't agree? Should the competition agency jump in and determine cost-based rates? Should they specify a RAND or FRAND commitment for interconnection? And if so, how will they determine what's fair and reasonable? What kind of issues have you found come into play in determining these behavioral remedies?
Oh, well, thank you, Rami. In Japan, the FCC on the issuing the season disease orders, JCC just to order that the violators to cease the violated conduct as well as not to be engaged in a similar conduct in the future, and the JCC in general and doesn't mention the contents of the concrete measures. Rather, the violators subject to the orders voluntarily consider the contents of the measures should be taken, and the FTC judges the measures whether the measures are adequate or not, and or the feasible or not, and so on. And the main point is that the measures is those which can restore the competition in the market. So in this case, the price which was offered by the Comcom, the price is adequate to restore the competition in the market or not. So this is an area of negotiation between the competition authority and the violators, and as well as the violators and its clients. The level of the price or the charge is not the matter that the competition authority should intervene, but the competition authority should do judge the outcome of the negotiation is adequate or not to restore the competition. Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe we can get a brief reaction from one of our other panelists on this question.
If I can jump in, it's Barbara speaking. I tend to agree with Hiroshi that if we were to think about a structural remedy in this case, one idea would be to ask Big Tel to interconnect with wireless seller and carriers and to provide both local exchange features and internet transport to adopt some type of fan term. The point about the cost-based rates that you suggested, Randy, they would depend on the whole structure. And I understand that if we are not talking about unbundled companies, then it would be hard to assess this cost-based rate. In any case, my view is that whenever the authority imposes the parties to adopt friend rates, there will be, of course, they could report this to the authority, and probably if it would be up to the market as well to measure to which extent those rates are indeed friend rates. So I agree with the point that was made by Diroshi that there will be some type of negotiation, but rather I would understand that other players in the market could also bring information to the authority to say that the rates that are being imposed are not allowing competition in that market. In my view, it seems very hard for the authority to establish a rate or fix the rate, but it would rather calibrate the rate whenever it is adopted on friend terms by the party. Maybe we could address later the issue of having a regulatory agency involved, but maybe a regulatory agency would be more prepared to address those in a specific rate rather than the competition authority.
Very good, and we'll come to the intersection with regulation in just a moment. I have one question before we get there. So now ComCom has put into an order a behavioral remedy that requires access and sets up a pricing mechanism. It can't then just go away and go on to the next case and forget about it. And what roles does the agency need to play in monitoring the industry and looking at the rates? Should it be in the position of monitoring and even changing those rates over time? And for how long should these remedies go on? Should these orders be indefinite, or should they be in place only till effective competition has been restored? And how would one judge that? So if you would like to come in on the question of the problem of monitoring behavioral remedies.
Well, I think that in fact in the markets often such as in telecommunications, there is a rapid technological innovation. I don't think that the measures ordered by the competent authority should remain as such in the future. So then I think that the market condition will alter the year by year. So then I think that the indefinite terms of the measures could be impossible. So I think that the definitive in terms of the measures would not be possible for the competition authority as well as for the companies. Thank you.
Thank you. And another perspective on this question of monitoring?
Well, I think that, I mean, we at the Bureau would probably support a behavioral remedy here in the form of wholesale access and interconnection for many of the reasons that were outlined by the other panelists. Monitoring a behavioral remedy is fairly simple when the behavioral remedy is a simple prohibition or a thou shalt not order. It's substantially more difficult when you're dealing with unbundling particular services and pricing those services. It's difficult to even identify the appropriate services in the first place, let alone determine what the right price is. In Canada, most of that is done by our telecom regulator, the CRTC. We generally think that a specific regulator is better suited to price and access regulation than a competition authority, primarily because it requires constant oversight, because it requires repeated tariff filings, because costs are dynamic and can change over time, new technologies can emerge. We've worked with them, we've made submissions on the scope of wholesale access, and we've encouraged them to reassess it, particularly as facilities-based competition has emerged from cable in this country. And so while there will be constant monitoring, this is the kind of thing that we feel should be revisited at a minimum every 3 to 5 years, particularly if you get technological bypass from another network or conditions in the marketplace change substantially. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's turn now to the point that Barbara raised about the intersection with regulation. Is this really a better case for a sectoral regulator to come in and oversee and regulate BigTel? And if so, what would be the relationship between the regulator's role and that of ComCom? And I'm going to ask just for a couple of brief reactions on this. Obviously, the intersection of competition and sectoral regulation can occupy a whole other program and more, but just for a couple of reactions on this basic question.
My view, Randy, in this context is that as we are talking about a market that seems to have a lot of market failures because of its structure, indeed it seems to be convenient to have a regulator overlooking the market. This does not mean that the competition authority would not have anything to do with that market, especially because there, even if regulation covers a bunch of things, there could be issues that there would be space still to competition. So my understanding is that in this type of market where you have those market failures, it may be convenient to have an authority overlooking, but having the competition authority or having a competition branch within the regulator assessing the competition issues that may arise.
Good. Anybody else have a brief comment on the intersection of regulation and competition? Okay. Well, maybe our audience does. At this point, I want to open it up for, let's take two questions now. Other questions hopefully we can come back to. In the end, I'm going to ask the operator to open up the phone lines, and those following on the slide know there's an email address to send questions. We've received one already that we'll pose. But operator, can you open up the line for questions at this point?
At this time, I'd like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
Well, while we're doing that, let me ask Andrew Heimert, who's with me and the recipient of questions, to ask the question we've received here.
All right. The first question comes from Ryan Hawthorne of the Competition Commission of South Africa, and he has asked whether any of the panelists have experience with what he describes as functional or operational separation remedies, which might involve registering the upstream and downstream operators in the hypothetical of BigTel in different companies with separate incentives for managers and with separate governance structures, say the board of directors for the two companies, but it might still be under common ownership, perhaps through shareholders or a single private owner.
Okay, can we get somebody to take a first try at that question?
Well, I can say that in Germany and in the EU, it would still be considered a structural remedy, and so far it has not been imposed in any case, with the exception of one case in the German energy sector where a completely structural remedy has been imposed, going a step further, i.e. ownership unbundling. But that was a very special case where the company had actually offered that remedy and where it was clear that ownership unbundling, and even in the form of a mild technical separation, may come in any event as a result of legislation. And there the company has said, well, if we have to do it anyway to divest or to separate the network, then we can also put that remedy on the table in the context of the antitrust. But apart from that special case, no structural remedy has ever been considered in Europe.
Yeah, if I can mention the situation of Brazil, we wouldn't have any experience of having that as a result of a structural remedy, but it comes back to the regulation issue because, as was mentioned, also this would be more linked to maybe a legislative issue, and pursuant to the regulatory authority, there are some requirements in terms of separating the structures and the functionalities and providing different incentives, but not as a result of anti-competitive conduct.
Good. Thanks. Good question. And now let's go to the phones.
Your next question comes from the line of Charles Webb. Your line is open.
Thanks. Chuck Webb from the JCRA in the Channel Islands in Jersey. Just a quick comment on the behavioral remedies here. I'd like the panel's response to this. I mean, it seems to me if you went stepping back, I find it kind of ironic that the facts of the case is there's currently no sectoral regulation because, in my opinion, if the competition agency would require BigTel to interconnect and then set the terms of access, by default, the competition agency becomes the sectoral telecommunications regulator. I mean, in effect, the competition agency is becoming the price regulator of wholesale access for fixed line and internet services. And the two bullet points here, I mean, setting cost-based rates, I mean, first of all, getting the proper allocation of costs in a telecommunications incumbent is a huge job. And second of all, you know, setting the FRAN terms to cover cost and to compete effectively. Well, to compete effectively can mean different things for different competitors, depending on how efficient they are, whether they have first mover advantages, et cetera. And to take Matthew Kellison's point, after you construct the remedy, which is a big job, it then requires constant monitoring in light of the rapidly changing field of telecommunications. So it just seems to me, in the real-world example, a competition agency really couldn't set this kind of remedy without the close cooperation, well, first the presence of, and then the second, the cooperation of the sectoral regulator.
Thanks for a good comment, Chuck. Any panelists want to react to that?
Oh, yeah.
Quick Coward?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are absolutely correct points. Just to observe, the structural remedies are never purely structural or very rarely so. And so a competition authority even there, without setting prices, but in determining what lines of business a firm can and cannot enter, may be put in the position of being a constant regulator over time. Let's not forget that Judge Green over roughly, 15 years heard, I think, 920 waiver petitions to the supposedly structural divisions of the AT&T consent decree. When you add price issues on top of that, you're putting the competition authority in the very tricky position of playing that regulatory role.
Any other reactions to Chuck's points? Okay. Let's move on, and if there are other questions on the phone, I don't have any other email questions. I hope we can come back to them, but let's also put the second scenario on the table. And at this point, let's move to hypothetical number two, which, if you'll bear with me, I will read through. This involves telco, the dominant provider of wired telephone services in TV land, with over 80% of the market. Again, not subject to sectoral regulation. Chuck mentioned this could be artificial, but we're just trying to get at the pure competition issues in particular. So, telco provides subscription TV services, pay TV, which it introduced 3 years ago in conjunction with upgrading its landline network from copper to fiber optics. To promote its pay TV when it introduced it, Telco offered bundled packages that provide consumers with discounts if they add subscription TV services to their wired phone service. Probably sounds familiar to many of us as consumers as well. TV Land has three other pay TV providers, each offering a similar range of programming that goes well beyond the two state-owned broadcast networks. Two land-based services, TV3 and TV4, and one satellite TV service, TV5, have 75% of the market, so each 25% share, down from 100% when Telco pay TV was introduced. Now the remaining 25% of the market is held by Telco pay TV. The Competition Commission of TV Land, again cleverly named ComCom, investigated the case and concluded that the practice violated its abuse of dominant provisions because the bundled price of pay TV service was below the relevant cost once the entire discount was allocated to the bundled product. Based on a rapid increase in Telco's market shares, ComCom also found that Telco was likely to acquire a dominant position if it were allowed to continue bundling. ComCom is now considering some alternative remedies. We mentioned four of them. First, prohibiting the bundle discounts. Second, placing a fixed limit on the discounts based on Telco's current relevant costs. Alternatively, a dynamic limit on the discounts based on the relevant costs of the other three providers, which ComCom would determine annually, or a fine that would be based on Telco's turnover. So with that backdrop, let's go back to our panel. And as you may have noticed, Hiroshi Yamada and Barbara Rosenberg took the wavering oar in responding to the questions on our first hypothetical. We're going to let them take a little bit of a rest, come back in when they'd like, and make our main responders to these questions will be Matthew Kellison and Wolfgang Dieselhoff. So I'm going to first ask, in crafting a remedy relating to price-cost behavior, what kind of difficulties and issues come up in relation to administrability, determining facts, and so forth? And let me first turn to Matthew.
Thanks, Randy. So price-cost tests are straightforward in theory. They can provide a bright line. We don't think they're applicable to every type of anti-competitive conduct that's out there. They work for predatory pricing. I think they're the right test for predatory pricing when you're dealing particularly with a standalone product because, you know, it sets a pretty high threshold, and the last thing we want to do is deter, low pricing that's beneficial to consumers. But when you sort of start to expand that and try to fit other things into that box, it can be a bit under-inclusive as a test. Partly because there's conduct that can raise rivals' costs and exclude them without any short-term profit loss, and in some cases without any price-based behavior whatsoever. But more specific to this example, in practice, it's easy to say price-cost, but in practice it's difficult to apply. Costs need to be accounted for and measured. They need to be classified as being fixed, sunk, variable, avoidable, long-run, incremental. This is usually a lot more complicated than even we think it's going to be. It almost always requires accounting work, sometimes forensic accounting work, if you've got someone that's exited the market. It requires, industry expertise. One of our recent cases dealing with predation was Air Canada, which involved allegations of predatory pricing by a dominant air carrier in an attempt to force rival airlines out of certain routes. That proceeding was quite complicated because it involved detailed accounting and classification of each and every one of Air Canada's costs. It was actually divided into two phases. In the first, it was determined finally that Air Canada was in fact pricing below its cost on a handful of routes, but whether or not that was an anti-competitive act that was substantially less than competition was left for the second phase of the trial, and in between Air Canada filed for creditor protection. Moreover, costs can be dynamic over time. As I said before, they will require ongoing monitoring. And even price can be difficult to assess because in cases where you've got bundled rebates or any situation involving volume or loyalty targets where prices change based on the quantity purchased, It can be difficult to sort of pick one price. Sometimes you need to aggregate those prices. It depends on how much is being bought in some cases. So like I said, if the issue is simply predation, price cost is probably the most effective. Where the price and cost targets are simple, it may be the most effective. Price cost can certainly give you some information as to whether or not a rival is going to be excluded. But in terms of administrability, it's particularly in bundling situations, it can be very difficult to apply. Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew. And Wolfgang, looking at this from a perspective of European law and from perspective of defense counsel, how would you analyze the administrability and other issues that come up in crafting a remedy in this situation?
Well, from a German EU perspective, the only remedies which would normally be considered are the prohibition of a discount plus a fine. So remedy providing for, let's say, a limitation on the discount, for instance, in relation to cost, would normally not be considered. Why is this so? Well, again, it relates to the principle of proportionality, which requires, at least in our understanding, that it is up to the company to bring the infringement to an end. And choose if there are several or suitable options available to achieve that objective. And therefore, in rebate cases, the implementing part of the decisions normally only provide for the following elements. First, the rebate is abusive with a detailed reasoning in the text of the decision why this is so. Second, the company is required to bring the infringement to an end. And third, a fine is imposed. For instance, in the recent Intel case, the European Commission ruled that Intel's loyalty rebates to Dell and HP were abusive and imposed a fine of €1 billion. And the decision then simply says Intel shall immediately bring the infringement to an end, full stop. Given that there are many options available how to bring the infringement to an end, no further specification whatsoever was given how to do that and how to structure the rebate in the future. However, in practice, what happens is that there are discussions with the Commission or the German Federal Cartel Office how to deal with rebate in the future, and you go to the agencies and say, this is what we have in mind to do in the future. Would you agree that this future rebate system is in line with the decision? Only in very, very few cases, and in fact, similarly as in Canada, mainly in predatory pricing cases, the Federal Cartel Office or the Commission have ordered to the company to set a given price. For instance, in one case, the German Federal Cartel Office, Lufthansa, the German air carrier Lufthansa, had engaged in predatory practices to squeeze out a new entrant on a given route, Frankfurt, Berlin. And there, the FCO ordered Lufthansa to charge at least €129 because Lufthansa would then cover its cost according to its own internal document. There, it was pretty easy to establish the cost, and therefore it was put in the decision itself with a duration of 2 years. But I think in general, it is better and probably in view of the principle of proportionality, the only right remedy just to prohibit the specific discount in question and leave it up to the company to come up with an effective remedy and not impose one on it. For the reason referred to by Howard earlier.
Well, good. I think the examples you raised, Wolfgang, put on the table very squarely some of the issues that come up in a prohibitory remedy. In one sense, it makes it easy for the agency, but then what kind of issues does that raise in terms of, and we'll look at the telco example, if they were simply prohibited from bundling, what effect would that have on their ability to pass on efficiencies of bundled product offerings or to compete against other companies that offer bundles? Does the prohibition provide enough guidance for the types of discounting that might be legal to other firms in the market? Are agencies choosing a prohibition remedy because others are too difficult, or is it in principle the best the best remedy. Let me ask Matthew what your reaction would be on those questions.
Thanks, Randy. Bundling is almost always a good thing for consumers. They find it convenient. They get a price discount. And as you mentioned, it usually generates efficiencies, in some cases significant efficiencies for the bundling firm. That's probably especially true in telecom when you're dealing with one pipe into the home and one bill and things of that nature. If all the firms in the market can offer the bundle, then what we'd really be concerned about is whether or not the overall price of that bundle was predatory, because we wouldn't be as concerned that it would be being used to harm a competitor offering a subset or even one of the products. Where there's standalone competitors, like there are in this example, in some cases a bundle can force them to expand their product line, which is usually a good thing. But in other cases, it can exclude them. And if it does exclude them, we'd want to look at how much more competitive that standalone market would be in the absence of the bundling. If consumers want the bundle in sufficient quantities that it's essentially its own product market, then it may not be as much of an issue. But if there's enough standalone demand for the pay TV service, and even if, perhaps the price wouldn't necessarily be lower if the bundle was prohibited, but there'd be greater choice or greater product quality or more innovation or any of the other non-price factors we would look at in a case like this, then we might consider a prohibition on the bundle to be the most appropriate. That would essentially lower the price or keep the price at a certain level in the standalone market, and then bundling firm could exercise their market power in the other, but to the extent that we could generate that competition in the standalone market through a prohibition, that would probably be what we'd look to do. Consumers can still elect to buy the products together from the bundling firm if they want and have that convenience, but they can also benefit from the standalone competition in the other market. Again, you mentioned that price cost is difficult to administer. That would be a big consideration. Our competition tribunal, where we litigate these matters, has also come out and told us in a decision that they are not a price regulator. They will not set a price at a certain level nor monitor that price going forward. They are much more inclined to just outright prohibit something, which they've done in past bundling cases, and that would probably be what we'd look at in a situation like this. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, we have, in Germany and at the EU level, we have made the experience that normally the decision itself, which just prohibits a certain discount, provides enough guidance for the companies to have a good idea what they can do in the future. And in case of doubt, they can still go back to the Commission or the German cartel office and say, well, listen, that's what we have in mind in the future, and let's discuss whether or not that is compatible with the decision. In that way, that leaves maximum flexibility to the dominant company still to set up the rebate scheme as they wish, while at the same time ensuring that there is an effective compliance. And for instance, you could argue that a bundle in this Hyper 2 scenario as such could be prohibited, number one, or number two, it is only prohibited if the bundle price does not cover the cost. And in both scenarios, the reasoning, you would find the reasoning in the decision itself, and that would give you sufficient guidance to see what you have to do in the future. I think there would be no need to put that in the decision, in the implementing part of the decision itself, how to come up with a new rebate system in the future.
Thank you. Any comments from Hiroshi or Barbara on these points?
I don't have anything to add to that, Randy.
Okay. Well, then let's take a look at the other remedies that ComCom could consider here, in particular the prohibition on offering bundled prices below telcos' costs, or the so-called dynamic one, limit on the bundled price. What issues would they raise? Would they offer some advantages? Would they raise problems for the agency in how to determine costs? Would the dynamic limit impose an inappropriate burden on telco competitors to provide cost information? What would you see as the considerations for the agency or the parties in these alternative remedies?
Well, I think we've touched on the administrability issue, so I'll leave that aside. One thing that jumps out at me when we talk about a dynamic limit on bundled price, in addition to having to assess competitors' costs, in addition to the dominant firm's costs, we would be concerned with any remedy based on rivals' costs. Because if nothing else, it would give them very little incentive to innovate or make their business more efficient if they know that by failing to do so, they can essentially keep a cap on their rivals' prices. So I think that's definitely something that we would look to avoid. Thanks.
Yeah, I can just confirm that the same principle apply here as well in Europe. And in fact, I think the agency would never consider a remedy calling for dynamic limits on bundled price and leave that just to the dominant companies for the reasons set out earlier.
And so we have a transatlantic consent. Sorry?
And certainly they would not consider a reference to the cost of a rival.
Huh?
Because that is just impossible to find out in a legal way.
Okay, then having looked at the prohibitory and price-limiting remedies, Comcom is also thinking of imposing a fine. How do you view the pros and cons of a fine as a deterrent that might avoid limiting efficiencies that can be gained from bundled pricing, or are there other pros and cons that you see to a fining remedy in this situation?
Well, I think I brought up our approach to administrative monetary penalties on the first question. I don't think we'd say it's preferable to other remedies, and in our case, it's not something that we would seek as an alternative, nor something that we could seek as an alternative. It would be in addition to a prohibition order. I do think it's potentially something we'd consider if we thought it would have a future deterrent effect, but we wouldn't want that kind of thing to be so deterrent that it would essentially eliminate any ability to bundle in the future. So that's something that would have to be weighed carefully. Thanks.
Well, as I said, while the agencies in Europe and Germany would consider first a prohibition and second a fine, I think in clear-cut cases where there's established safer, for instance, on loyalty rebates, the agency has a fine and a significant fine. For instance, the European Commission has its fining guidelines, which apply not only to cartels, but also to, which could also apply to practices in relation to unilateral conduct. And there we see in practice the problem that that application of those guidelines may lead to very excessive fines. The calculation is based on a percentage of the effective turnover with the products where the rebates have been applied. And if it's a clear-cut violation, a loyalty rebate, normally they would go for 5, 10, or 15% of the effective turnover. And we have seen cases where the Commission has said, well, this is completely inappropriate, and we need to find another mechanism to come up with a proportionate sanction. So sanction, yes, but the guidelines need to be applied in a very flexible way to make sure that these fines are not completely out of order. And I mean, the Intel case is a $1 billion in relation to a loyalty rebate case.
Yeah.
And for instance,
okay. Well, before we turn back to questions, let me ask all of the panelists if there are any other observations they would like to make in relation to this hypothetical or the issues raised generally in bundle discounting cases such as this.
If not, then operator, if you can open up the phone lines again. And in the meantime, we've received a question by email that Andrew Heimer will now pose.
Thank you. This question comes from Yonatan Quickel of the Israel Antitrust Authority, and I apologize if I pronounced the name incorrectly. The question is, considering that consumers benefit from the ability to purchase bundled services, could a remedy involve creating a wholesale market by imposing duty-to-deal provisions, which would then allow competitors to bundle their services with some of the services provided by the dominant telco?
All right, we have someone to take a swing at that, or is there any clarification required? Howard?
I'll take a swing at it. I mean, that kind of thing has been tried and certainly could be tried in a market where a firm provided some but not all of a bundle, a competing firm provided some but not all elements of a bundle. You might let that firm purchase the missing elements at wholesale and resell them. Numerous places around the world have experimented with this kind of wholesale access and then reselling, and there are places where it's been very successful. I would identify France. There are places where it was notably less successful. I would identify the United States. The key point is that the wholesale pricing brings to bear roughly the same complexities and difficulties as the retail price regulation, but in some cases, where done well, it can work well.
And I would
any other
comment? It's something that we've seen a little bit here in Canada as part of our wholesale access regime, where there have been services that have been unbundled in part because competitors need them to offer a triple play of three products. I would point out, though, that based on what we were talking about a little bit earlier, that we would view essentially as more of a regulatory solution than a competition law remedy, which would, again, require the appropriate pricing and monitoring. So from our perspective, it would certainly be easier to seek a prohibition, but in terms of something that might dovetail with a wholesale regulatory regime, that's something that can work.
Good, thanks. Operator, let's see if there are any questions on the phone.
Again, if you'd like to ask a question, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for another moment to compile the Q&A roster. There are no further questions at this time.
Okay, I would then ask if there are any final comments from our panelists, and then I would turn it over to Howard Chalansky for a wrap-up. Among our panel, any final comments on any of the issues on which we've touched today?
Nope.
Okay, then over to Howard.
Well, first, we've heard some very good comments from across our panelists, and I would like to just summarize a few of the key points that came up. I think in application to the two hypotheticals that the panelists addressed, we saw a lot of the interplay and the comparative costs and advantages of different unilateral conduct remedies. I think some of the key points that we've heard that I would like to repeat and bear keeping in mind are the following. First, as Barbara Rosenberg pointed out, the goal is not to prevent lawful monopoly in most cases, but to cure the competitive excesses of that monopoly. So the goal is to bring the conduct to an end, the illegal conduct to an end, but not necessarily the lawfully achieved monopoly to an end. And that, I think, bears considering when one thinks about moving beyond behavioral remedies to structural remedies. And we need to think very carefully about at what point a structural remedy does interfere with a lawfully achieved structure. And in light of the other costs we've heard about today with regard to structural remedies, the need often for more behavioral and continued oversight than is often recognized, the degree to which even a structural remedy can become regulatory. Despite the attractive structural features, we may come to some kind of conclusion that structural remedies really are a last resort when a behavioral remedy can't work and the lawful monopoly cannot be trusted or constrained to act in a legal manner. I think that we heard from Wolfgang, I think, a very important reminder that while affirmative remedies like mandatory dealing in a refusal to deal case are often portrayed as much more difficult than prohibitory remedies, sometimes they are simply what is necessary to restore competition. And in fact, a refusal to deal, the prohibition on a refusal on refusing to deal implies, of course, the affirmative duty to deal. And so the separation between a prohibitory and an affirmative conduct remedy is not often so clear, and that we can resort to certain benchmarks for identifying the regulatory price. And this says that we should not always flee from affirmative conduct remedies that require the setting of the price. FRAND terms, for example, where there are reasonable benchmarks for what constitutes FRAND, may be quite reasonable ways to get at affirmative conduct remedies and to make them effective. From Hiroshi, we heard a good reminder about the dynamic changes that often occur over the lifetime of a remedy, and that ongoing monitoring and measures that can allow a remedy to adapt or be withdrawn with rapid technological change, with changes in market conditions, are going to be essential. Now, that's going to be a lot more difficult in a structural remedy, and so you want to be quite certain that a structural remedy will be one that is not adapted merely to the static circumstances of the anti-competitive conduct, but to the longer-term dynamic changes. Structural conduct remedies may be more amenable to that kind of dynamic change, and I think that's also a very valuable point to keep in mind. I won't address the specific answers to the hypotheticals. I would just say that I think we've come up with some very keen insights today about the trade-offs between affirmative remedies, prohibitory remedies on the conduct side, structural remedies, and penalties. And this will obviously be an ongoing discussion, and the key decisions will vary very much case by case.
Thank you, Howard. Before turning it over to Marcus for closing remarks, I've got three ministerial points to make. First, we very much welcome your feedback on this teleseminar, the format and, in general, the content, the presentation. This is our second one. We'd like to continue doing them. We'd be very interested in your thoughts on whether these are valuable and how they can be made more valuable. Second, we try to get a sense of how many people are with us on the line. Hard to know. If there are multiple people listening with you, if you could take a second and let us know that, we'd be very appreciative. Both of those types of information, if you could email them to Cynthia Lagdameo at the FTC, and if you don't, I think Cynthia and her email address are world famous, but if you don't have them, let one of us know or somebody at the agency, and they'll get that information to Cynthia. Finally, the materials for this program will be on the website. The slides are all on the ICN website. The slides are already there. We will add to that Howard Chalansky's presentation and a recording of this program. With that, I turn over to Marcus Lange for our closing remarks.
Thank you very much, Randy. Well, yes, I would like to thank our panel and Randy as the moderator of the panel of Howard Schelansky, Wolfgang Dieseles, Matthew Callison, Barbara Rosenberg, and Hiroshi Yamada for this excellent discussion of our remedies topic, and I think we've seen that there are a lot of very difficult questions to consider, and I think it was timely for us to address this issue of remedies that in the regular work of our unilateral conduct working group we had not addressed so far, and so this forum was a very good opportunity to get an overview of experiences and state of discussion. Let me just say a few more words on the regular work of the working group. The outline for the progress on our report on refusal to deal is going ahead. We've had more than 40 responses to our questionnaire, which are all posted on the ICN website, and the report is taking shape more and more, and is about to be finished and will be presented, of course, at the upcoming annual conference. I would like to thank everyone who has contributed to this report, be it by answering the questionnaire and handing in very useful and excellent answers, or be it by collaborating on drawing up the report. I've mentioned the annual conference. Our annual conference program is also taking shape. We will be discussing the issue of margin squeeze in the plenary structure debate of the conference. More on that and on other issues concerning our working group, and particularly also on the work plan for the next working year, can be discussed on March 17th when we are holding our next conference call. That will be a call for members and for NGAs, a joint call. So please mark the date, March 17th, our next unilateral conduct working group conference call. Okay. Well, for any questions regarding the unilateral conduct group, please contact us. The best addresses are Cynthia Lachtemeyer at the FTC and Tito Reimers at the Bundeskartellamt. So we're looking forward to being in touch with you. And thank you very much for listening in and participating in today's teleseminar. Thank you very much again to our excellent participants in the panel. We'll talk to you next week in our working group call. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you very much, and goodbye.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.